Welcome to a special edition of Late Night Live this afternoon on RN. We bring you a profile of Malcolm Fraser's entire life, not just his political life. It's an extended conversation between Philip Adams and Mr. Fraser, recorded in his office back in February 2001.
As I get older, I'm often astonished, dear listener, by the way our perceptions of people change, and perhaps the people themselves. I think, for example, of B.A. Santa Maria, whom was regarded as a sort of a monster of the right. But he kept on keeping on, and towards the end of his life, I'd bump into colleagues at the ABC who saw him pretty much as a fire-breathing radical. I'm not sure that Santa changed, but the world around him changed. Something similar has happened with the gentleman sitting opposite me in his remarkable office, a very prime ministerial office high above Collins Street. It's Malcolm Fraser. There was a time when I regarded Malcolm with, a great amount of hostility. I saw him as the devil incarnate back in 75. These days, like many people of my persuasion, I see him as a great hero. And I'm wondering whether it's Malcolm who's changed or whether it's me. So let's find out. Malcolm, there was a time when you were pretty much the driving force of the right wing of the Liberal Party. On issues like abortion, on censorship, you were stern and unflinching. You were without question a hawk on Vietnam. Now, on the other hand, you were on the progressive side on apartheid. The Malcolm Fraser we see now is a champion for human rights issues. He's first to come out with the great statement on immigration policies. Have you changed, or is it our perceptions of you?
I don't think basically I've changed, but people are obviously influenced by the world around them and by what's happening. In the middle 70s, I felt very strongly that governments had tried to spend their way out of trouble right around the world. And I think my predecessor government tried to do that in Australia. So fiscally, in monetary terms, I think I was, and I'd remain conservative and prudent. But on social, human issues, things that affect the lives of men and women, the question of attitudes, my ideas might have sharpened, but I don't think they've changed.
I'd like to talk about your early life, and I thought I knew something about it, but my researchers have proved me wrong. The media typically portrayed you as coming from Western District aristocracy, but that isn't quite true, is it? Can you tell us a bit about your Scottish, Canadian, New Zealand Jewish heritage?
Well, my grandfather came from Nova Scotia. He arrived here about 1848, and he came from a very impoverished village. Nova Scotia, I think, is still a very impoverished province, and it's a place to which Scots often fled, moved, but it was probably too dangerous to stay in Scotland. And after 1745, after Culloden, my ancestors had been on the wrong side of the contest, and there were Frasers, or was a Fraser who had his head chopped off at that time, but my more direct ancestors went to Nova Scotia. My grandfather, looking for wider fields, came to Australia and had been lured by the talk of gold. He'd moved across Canada and didn't stop when he came to the Pacific. He came on to this country. He had an interesting history because he did many things. He was a road contractor, he built railways, he became a merchant, he became a grazier, a banker. He was present at all the early conferences, conventions, as a delegate or representative for the state of Victoria. He was in the Victorian upper house. And after that, he became a foundation senator. I have some of his notes on the early forms of the Constitution. He was innovative. In, I think it was 1867, he thought there was artesian water underneath a large part of Queensland, parts of New South Wales, moving into the Northern Territory. People had tried to bore for artesian water and had always failed. He brought out a Canadian oil boring team with better equipment, could drill deeper, and the first hole they put down was at a place called Sir Laguna, and it struck artesian water. That was in far western Queensland. It was north of Bourke, but over the border, and south of Cunnamulla. So he had an interesting history. He was a builder in many ways. He also, I'm told, was about the first person who allowed or even asked AWU organisers to come onto his property in the Riverina to talk to station employees at the time. Now, going back more than a century, because we're in a new one at the moment, a very new one, that wouldn't have been a particularly common action. On my mother's side, her parents came from New Zealand. Her father had actually become bankrupt in New Zealand, and I think he then moved as far as he could from his original home, or as far as his money would allow, and that was Perth. And he established a new business there. And there was some Jewish blood on my mother's side of the family. I think I was lucky in my parents. I think they were great people.
Let's use this artesian principle and now drill a little deeper into your childhood. You grow up with your sister Lorraine in isolation from other children. Then Lorraine goes off to boarding school and you're much more isolated. And there are images of you in this childhood, this long childhood, very solitary. Did this make you the solitary figure you became? Because you were always a sort of a lonely figure in the landscape, even during your busiest political years.
Well, it might have. There are a number of reasons why we spent so much time in Riverina. Looking back at it, I can see how solitary it was. I never felt it was solitary. I could go riding over quite a large part of the country. I think going 20 miles in an afternoon was, we probably belted the horses along too much and didn't think enough of them in those days. But I can also remember riding at a very young age through 5,000 acres of leasehold forest country, River Red Gums, which was probably the country I liked or loved most. I can remember my father saying to me, you know, because station hands had got lost in this country and sometimes it took 2 or 3 days to find them. He said, you'd never go into the forest country by yourself, would you? And I'd been doing it for about 2 years when he said that. But I enjoyed that country. Perhaps I didn't know any other. This was just the life that I had. I wasn't conscious of missing something or losing something.
Thinking back, do you think that this period taught you to value individualism rather than collectivism?
Possibly, but those words can mean so many different things to different people. You can't value individualism at the expense of the impact of that individual on other people. Some things can be much better done in a group and can't be done as an individual. So, I think I plead Well, a Scott's verdict on that particular question.
You're nine when the Second World War breaks out. Your dad's working with the Air Force. You're moved to Melbourne and sent to Miss McComas's prep school in Toorak. Well, then to Tudor House in New South Wales. Mm. Were these happy years?
I never really enjoyed school. It's an odd thing to say because I think most of my grandchildren do enjoy school and I'm very glad that they do. But I always felt that I had to do too many things that I didn't really want to do. I knew I had to do them. There was no question of that. And therefore, I was looking forward to the day when I could leave school and make up my own mind what I would be doing. I can remember my father telling me that when you're at school, you're freer, more open, you've got less obligations than you'll ever have afterwards. That's one of those things that a father tells a child. It's true, but the child's not going to really believe it because he has his own perceptions. I'm an adult when I leave school. I can make my own decisions, and you don't really understand the pressures of life, of community, of all sorts of things that bear in on all of us.
You finished school in 48, Malcolm, and incidentally, this is Malcolm Fraser, and it's Late Night Live on Radio National. You go straight to your father's old college at Oxford, where you study philosophy, economics, and politics. So you're now thinking about politics.
I had some discussion with Bob Southey, who'd come down from Oxford shortly before I went to Oxford. Bob was a good deal older than I was, but he'd been to the war, and so he did a post-war degree, and that's why his timing was somewhat similar to mine in terms of Oxford. I either wanted to do law, or Bob decided that I should, spoke to me about modern greats, as the course he described was called. And he persuaded me to settle on modern greats. I wish I'd done both, because lawyers always, or political lawyers anyway, often had a sense of superiority. They were the only people who could read a bill. They're the only people who could draft something. It wasn't true, but if I'd had a law degree as well as the degrees I had, it would have been useful. I really thought I wanted to be a farmer, but I also thought I wanted to do something else that would fit in and not interrupt too much the farming life. Something would be alongside it, if you like. And quite mistakenly, I thought, well, politics, you can still be a farmer. Well, you can still own a farm, but once you commit yourself to politics, you can't really work on the farm. You can know enough to know what's going on, what you're trying to do, but in terms of real work on your own account, it's just not possible. We had quite a lot of lawyers in those days who used to take their briefs and argue cases and still be politicians. If you were representing a rural seat, and especially one that had been won from the political enemy, that sort of dual approach just wasn't possible.
Why the Liberal Party and not the Country Party?
My father would have been a Liberal. He would have known he did know Dick Casey very well. I'd met Dick Casey. The part of the world where I lived was strongly represented by the Liberal Party. There were a number of branch organisations. I think at one point in Wannon, we had as many members in Wannon, Liberal Party members, as there were in the entire state of Queensland. So Victoria Liberals always had a tradition of representing the countryside just as much as the National Party, or the Country Party as it then was. And I wouldn't have wanted to represent a party that didn't try to represent the total national interest. The Country Party
and
was
you felt
a
it was
sectional
too
party.
Sectional, yeah.
Yes, it would have been too sectional.
And it was a bit of sort of agrarian socialist too, and that was never your speed, was it?
Well, no, not in those days. In Victoria especially, the Country Party had done deals with the Labour Party and deals with the Liberal Party. In fact, everyone did deals with everyone else in the late 40s and early 1950s. And I can remember when trying to fight a federal election that everyone was desperately trying to hope that the state people would behave and that state issues could stay buried.
The Melbourne Liberals, you mentioned Casey. What about Menzies? Was he a family connection?
My father knew him, but not a family connection, no. They wouldn't have crossed paths except in the remotest way.
Later, of course, you hammer out a sort of relationship with Menzies, but let me read you something from a biographical piece in you written in 1976. Sir Percy Spender wrote of Menzies that in his early days he was, quote, never sure of his personal relations with people, especially his parliamentary colleagues. He found it hard to accommodate himself to ordinary mortals and had an air of studied aloofness. This could almost equally be said of Fraser. There have been similarities in their careers. Menzies as Attorney General in 1939 attacks his Prime Minister Joe Lyons, resigned from the Cabinet, and openly opposed him as party leader. He spent time on the backbench recovering from his party's rejection of him. A final similarity is that Menzies, as Fraser was to do three decades later, formulated a new philosophy for the Liberal Party. Are you conscious of those parallels?
Oh, background. I'm not sure that I'm conscious of formulating a new philosophy for the Liberal Party, although I did try to set into some sort of principled and philosophic structure the ideas and purposes of the party. I suppose there are some similarities there, but Menzies had had a life which depended upon meeting people, probably throughout his entire life. And mine had been very remote, certainly up to 1944.
You win pre-selection in 54, and you win the seat on Labour Party anti-communist preferences. Now, as you've already said, it wasn't a safe Liberal seat, and had the Country Party run a candidate against you, you might well have lost in those early years. How hard was it to retain the seat?
I always regarded it as a Labour seat because it had been Labour most of its life. I mean, at different periods, the Country Party had held it. Donnie McLeod, who didn't stand against me in 1955. He had in 1954, but he was Labour, and he'd won it from Dan McKinnon, who moved to Corangamite. I just thought that, you know, if you're going to go into politics, you've got to try and have a secure base. You can't have a secure base if you're going to win a seat one election and lose it the next. And therefore I decided to work at it. And that's when I decided that it didn't really fit alongside farming, because working at the electorate left no time, really, for farming. And although I farm was very much part of my life until very recently, I think I tried new ways of persuading an electorate that I would support their causes and that I would represent them as fairly and justly as I could.
What new ways?
Well,
I mean, you weren't a party animal in that sense, were you? You weren't a backslapper,
no,
a hand pumper, a baby kisser.
Well, maybe they were old ways. But for 18 months, I went around in a Holden ute, and where I saw people, I stopped and said, hello, I'm the Liberal candidate, etc., etc. I'd never asked them to vote for me. I'd just say, I want you to know who you're voting for or who you're voting against. One day, which had been wet and cold and nobody was outside, I went into 14 pubs. I'm horrified at the... And always in the public side of the bar, never in the saloon side of the bar. And people got used to me doing this sort of thing. I'd call out at Borthwick's, which had employees that varied from 400 probably to the best part of 1,000 people at Borthwick's Meatworks in Portland. And Ray Stiles, a union rep of a communist union, would call to order and give me a chance to say whatever I wanted to say, which was only, well, here I am again. If any of you have problems you think I can help with, well, please let me know. Or if you've got any questions you want to ask me, please ask them. It was always a gentle approach.
Well, it worked, didn't it?
Well, it did work, but, in the end, the first time you do this sort of thing, people probably say, oh, he's just after votes. But when it becomes clear that this is a service that you intend to continue to provide, then I think you start to win respect and win some support.
You get into Parliament when you're 25, and you spend the first 10 years on the back bench. Two issues dominate these years, they're economics and immigration. You were a firm opponent of high tariffs, a milder opponent of subsidies, and you argued that immigration was too rapid and unselective. Now, I know that one of the things that set you apart from other Liberals was that you had policies at all, because it was a time of something of a policy vacuum, but how much support did you get for those policies within the party?
Well, for immigration, I was probably wrong. I think I was looking at the issues on a too short-term basis, because I'm one of those who really believe that Australia needs, sometime through this century, over 40 million people. I believe we will be more independent, more secure, more confident of ourselves, and better able to influence our own region in relation to our own values and objectives if we were more substantial than we are today. So there probably wasn't much support for reduced immigration. We also have to remember that the immigration program had been supported by Arthur Calwell. It had been supported on the basis of 10 people coming from Britain for every person who came from somewhere else in Europe. And, of course, it was started on the basis of a white Australia immigration. But if it was going to start at all, no politician could have started it on another basis. It was only 7 years after the end of the Great Depression. People had experienced that. The first job for too many people was in the armed services. And but there were some defining issues, or in a sense it was a defining moment in Australia. If there'd been a Liberal government in 1946, it could not have persuaded the union movement to accept that program. But it continued the program basically as it had been started. And the new immigration minister in 1950, probably Harold Holt, but I'm not 100% sure, made it clear that the broad guidelines established by Calwell were not going to be altered. There was a sense of building a nation, of creating something worthwhile, of putting resources aside to build for the future. And so, this wasn't something you could turn off and on like a tap. There was a consensus across political parties. There was also a network of organisations whose purpose was to support the migration program. And I can remember some of them having something to say to me at the time. So the environment was, let's grow, let's expand. And I think I was wrong to suggest that there should be a break on that.
If you were wrong on that, do you now concede that you might have been wrong on Vietnam? Now, there's a link here. You have always been concerned, and it's a concern that's echoed today by, for example, Kim Beazley, that the future of this nation is by no means secure, that Australia's survival in the next century is not a given. So one of the ways you see of dealing with that is having an increased population. The other was, at the time, a very firm attitude on Vietnam, really a domino theory fear of the, in the region. Yeah. Given the tragic outcome of that war, both for us and for them, did you make a mistake?
I really find it hard to answer that. And I think I don't know the answer, because it depends what would have happened if there had been no Vietnam. Care Australia now works and has a very effective operation in Vietnam. And I wondered what sort of reaction I'd get when I first went there, when we established a mission there. Nobody wanted to talk about the past. It was all the future, building a nation, building a country. I'd had a letter from one minister when I launched a campaign here to raise funds for Vietnam. So there were no lasting consequences in terms of a relationship between two countries. But the environment of those times was very different from today's environment. And it was an environment where people could be influenced in different ways and very strongly. The insurgency, let me just mention a couple of things. The insurgency in Malaysia went on for, well, Malaya, before Malaya became independent, for 10, 11 years. And the insurgency was a communist insurgency. And Britain, Malaysia, troops and paramilitaries, New Zealand and Australia were all involved in trying to overcome that. Then only 4 or 5 years later, a PKI attempted coup in Indonesia. If General Nasution had not got out that bathroom window, would Aidit, the PKI, have taken charge? It's an open question. There's no doubt that that attempted coup and concern about China and concern about communism in Indonesia influenced Indonesia's view about East Timor some years later. So looking at it from today's perspective, the Cold War's over, communism's not a threat. But that's not the world we lived in those days. And when people in Thailand, people like Lee Kuan Yew, who was most circumspect in relation to the Vietnam War, but he always said to me it was important because it gave ASEAN, for example, time to strengthen their own institutions, to be more secure in themselves. And he said that time was very important. If the Vietnam War had not taken place, that time might not have been available to us. So, you know, if that's true, as Lee Kuan Yew believed it to be, and I think still believes it to be, it wasn't all bad as a result of the Vietnam War. But knowing other things I know now, which I didn't know at the time, and I didn't participate in the decisions. I was, in a sense, an army administrator carrying out policy that actually had been made before I joined the government. That's not being said as an excuse. It's just stating a fact. I did say to the Defence Minister at the time that we should have somebody in the innermost policy circles in Washington, because otherwise we didn't know what was going to happen in the conduct of the war. And if I'd read McNamara's book, the one that was published just a few short years ago, where he talks about the decisions and the manner of the execution of President Diem, imagine the United States at the highest level, in the White House, making the decision to knock off the head of government of an ally in a conflict. That's, you know, that's an extraordinary thing for a country to do. And while the very fact that the United States believed she had the right to do that, not only the power to do it, but the right. McNamara in his book says it's wrong, but he never really questioned the right of America to do that sort of thing if America thought it was in America's interests. Now, I wouldn't want to be an ally of a country behaves like that. And if I'd known that that was what America was doing, I'm sure my attitude to participation with the United States as an ally would have been significantly altered. When I became defense minister, I would have then started to say, well, if you want us to continue to support you, we have got to have somebody in the policy councils where you're determining issues.
That's a bit like Menzies, isn't it, in the Second World War?
Well, I don't think he trusted Churchill at the beginning of the war. Mm. I think this is one of the reasons why Menzies stayed so long in Britain, not because he was bemused, I think, by British society and all the rest. I think he was really concerned that Australia would be left vulnerable and alone, and he didn't know how really to prevent that.
He's Malcolm Fraser. I'm Philip Adams. This is LNL on Radio National. We all know of your rapprochement with Whitlam, and I think we've got to put this into context. When you made your maiden speech, Gough was one of the first people to come over and congratulate you, as I recall. People forget that there are often quite strong cross-political friendships. Nixon and Kennedy, for example, before they contested the presidential election. And Gough, in fact, now says of you that you're always a pretty good fella. I'm more interested in the state of play with you and John Gorton. Have you and John, who was a mentor for you for a time, ever patched it up?
Not to this point.
You'll have to hurry.
Well, it's one of the things that saddens me sometimes, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Santa Maria, you were quite close to Santa for a while, weren't you?
Yes.
He endorsed your view of Asia, for example.
Yes, he would have, and I was close to him before it was really fashionable to be close to him too.
Why?
I thought he had a viewpoint, an important one. I liked the way he wrote. He had a clear mind. You can't get away. In today's world, people think I'm on the left of politics. But that's because, in my view, that's because the whole political spectrum has moved to the right. You can't compare Kim Beazley's Labour Party with a Labour Party which would have been dominated by communist trade unions, for example, or significantly influenced by communist-led trade unions. That's not today's world. But it was the world then. And while in the 1950s we grew up in an optimistic period, we believed with Keynesian economics, which the economic rationalists decry absolutely, that the economic problems of the world could be solved, that unemployment could become a thing of the past, that we knew how to manage our economies better, that the Great Depression would never happen again. So it was an optimistic period. But what could challenge that optimism? What could defeat it? And the challenges would either be from the extreme right or the extreme left. And the more extreme people become in their politics, the more similar they become. And the challenge, plainly, was from communism, because that was the power of the times. So there was a great deal of concern. There was a great deal of fear. I know there are people who believe that this was always taken too far, but I think most people would concede that they could understand why that concern was there. And I certainly shared in that concern. I shared in it because I had 3 or 4 hours with Aid at once, 3 or 4 months before that coup. Mick Shan had taken me to meet him. I met a number of people in Jakarta on that visit, a number of them after dinner in their own homes, because it wouldn't have been done to be seen walking into their offices. It was a strange environment. There was a great deal of unease around. Today we've lost a lot of that. Although with what's happening in Indonesia, I think people should be uneasy again.
At the moment, there's a new, shiny, bright president sitting in Pennsylvania Avenue who must be worried at some levels about his authenticity in the office. Kennedy, in his time, of course, could have shared that concern, given that he probably nicked the election from Nixon with dodgy votes in Chicago, aided by Mayor Daley. Did you have that problem after 75? Did you sometimes feel, sitting in the lodge, a sense of inauthenticity?
No, I didn't. And I think for two reasons. Once something was passed, it was passed, and I didn't spend much time worrying about it. You couldn't change what had happened, it happened. But also, the majorities in the election in 1975 were substantial.
Yes, Gough couldn't call for a recount, could he?
Well, the difference was too great. And that majority, I think, said, well, all right, a majority of people wanted to get rid of that government, even if they didn't particularly like the blocking of supply. And I still think that that's the substantial answer. They did it not just then, they did it again in 77.
Malcolm, the Prime Minister who emerges surprises his friends and his enemies. Both sides are a bit shocked. Now, I've been talking to Beryl Beaurepaire a bit on the program, and Beryl's a great admirer of yours. She says you were one of the greatest supporters of women in the Liberal Party in terms of social change. Clearly, you were a great opponent of apartheid. Clearly, you started involving yourself in the issues of land rights, Aboriginal issues. Where did this impulse come from? Is this mum? Is it dad? Is it reading? Is it Ayn Rand? Where are you getting this from?
In the end, I think it's just something that's in a person. It can't just be that, because people don't come out of nothing. You have your parents. And so whatever they were obviously has influenced me. But the thing that really annoys me is when I see discrimination against people because they're a member of a group or a class, or whether it's just a person. It's just as bad. Any element of racism, I think it is something above and beyond politics. It's to be condemned.
But you came from a class, Malcolm, where it was not uncommon. You well remember the institutionalized anti-Semitism in this town in which we're sitting.
And not only that, but the bitterness between Catholic and Protestant, derived
Absolutely.
From China, Billy Hughes' activities in the First War, and Archbishop Mannix, when he tried to make those conscription votes an anti-Irish, anti-Catholic vote, which Billy Hughes thought he'd win. He divided and ran the risk of destroying a nation by taking that path.
And we've seen a similar phenomenon to that more recently. You're looking
yes.
blank.
Similar, but the nation is wiser than it was then. And I think we've tackled ethnic differences in the post-war period in establishing a multicultural society which owes a lot to the ethnic community leaders from, well over 100 countries, but also to the attitude of governments. We're not playing Billy Hughes the second time around. Pauline Hanson is a somewhat different phenomenon. To me, she's more a consequence of neglect than of racism. People who believe they've just been pushed aside by the whole political process, people who believe they're no longer relevant. And then somebody strange comes along and offers some sort of alternative. Whether they like the alternative offered or not, many people probably don't think about much.
But it also must have concerned you to see the party that you once led bend to her will so readily, and of course the National Party, and to a lesser extent even the Labour Party.
on some of these issues, I think all political parties are at fault. My own party did not condemn Pauline Hanson when she first arrived, and should have, maintained the atmosphere, the attitude that you do discredit to yourself if you act like a racist, if you speak like a racist. And somehow or other, that sort of language almost got made respectable. I say almost because I don't think it is respectable, and I don't think many people regard it as a legitimate argument of any kind. But why political parties can't act more effectively or speak more effectively about things like mandatory sentencing, which affect the Indigenous population in Western Australia or in the Northern Territory, is it because they want the vote of people who might support Pauline Hanson? I would have thought the Labor Party would be absolutely opposed to mandatory sentencing. But I can't find official statements that say they will exercise federal power to overturn it.
There was a strange silence on that issue. Mind you, you'd always argued that it was the job of the leader to lead. You were never a populist leader. You were never poll-driven. Long before you got the leadership, you'd speak often to an empty House of Parliament as a young backbencher. But you'd argue very passionately that political leadership was about taking sometimes unpopular positions for the good of the nation in the hope that people would catch up with you. That's almost Keating-esque.
Well, perhaps it is. And one of the things that I think has perhaps been missed about Paul Keating is that he really did have a view, I'm sure still does have a view, an idea about where he'd like Australia to go. I believe he put a lot of people off in his public speeches because of the language he used, the examples he drew, perhaps. But he had an idea, more so than many other people, about what ought to happen to this country.
Well, you've made it quite clear what you think ought to happen lately. Oh, look, before we move on to this, let's go back to your time as Prime Minister. What are you most proud of?
I wouldn't have said this in 1983, but for something which most people at the time probably hadn't realised in their minds, hadn't understood what was happening or what the government was doing. In domestic and in foreign policy, we took a totally consistent attitude to the advancement of human rights, whether in Australia or in the wider world. Foreign policy, in spite of the tragedies that have occurred since in relation to Rhodesia and South Africa, the attitude my government and subsequent governments took, I think, was consistent with that. But in Australia, and this is where people weren't watching what the government had done, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, the Ombudsman, the Human Rights Commission, were all supported or established in my time. The Galbally Report on post-arrival services for migrants, which really entrenched multiculturalism in a way which made it impossible to get rid of multiculturalism, because we are, in fact, just that, a multicultural society. And, you know, reports quite recently into whether we should or shouldn't be called that have ended up saying, well, there's no real option. And the fact that Australia is a thoroughly successful multicultural society, not a society in which Greeks or Italians or Vietnamese or people from somewhere else might be saying, well, loyalty to their original or land of origin is more important than loyalty to Australia, because they all commit themselves absolutely to our institutions, to our processes, to our democracy.
You're talking an attitude rather than a single piece of legislation, aren't you? You're talking a feeling about what you were doing rather than particularising.
It was a feeling, but legislation was involved in nearly every part of when you talk of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, Human Rights Commission, the Ombudsman, when you talk about the Post-Arrival Service for Migrants, the establishment of SBS, all of this, of course, involved legislation.
Mm.
But it was all based on a view about the relationship of government to people. It was all based especially, and land rights for Aboriginals, which I hadn't mentioned. It was all based about the need for every person, every group, to have their own place in this society, to be able to feel self-esteem, to be accorded basic human dignity.
Were you dragging your colleagues, kicking and struggling down this path, or did they come easily?
I think they tolerated me in some of these things. It was known that I felt strongly about these issues. Much is owed to Bob Ellicott's attitude on these same questions. And I don't think there were major problems in terms of government attitude, but in the things that affected the Commonwealth, the Commonwealth of Nations and its foreign policy, I think some accepted it with a degree of tolerance, perhaps believing that it wasn't really affecting anything, when in fact we affected a great deal.
In other words, they saw them as marginal issues and didn't worry that much.
Well, I was told by somebody in November of last year that a number of these issues are marginal issues, peripheral issues of no importance. I happen to believe that these issues are fundamental, and perhaps I hold that view more strongly now than when I was in government, because with Care Australia, we've been working in so many areas where intolerance and racism and bigotry have resulted in many, many thousands, tens of thousands of people being killed or slaughtered. And that, you know, just recommits me to the view that when you see racism put up its hand anywhere, it should be argued down.
What's happened to your hand? I noticed
I've got a sprained wrist.
Oh, right. Well, that's because you've been putting up your hand quite often on the reconciliation issue, I guess. That's probably how that happened. What role should government be playing now in reconciliation, irrespective of who is in government?
I'm not sure that anyone has yet got the complete answer to this. It's not just a question of money, although in many cases it is a question of money. But it's a question of re-establishing the circumstances in which our Indigenous population can feel a sense of self-esteem and dignity in the Australian community. Noel Pearson speaks a great deal about what's wrong with past policies, but I'm not sure that he speaks so clearly about what policies should be put in place. But I have been told enough of what's happening across northern Australia and in Arnhem Land and northern Queensland to be greatly saddened at the breakdown in social structures amongst many of the Aboriginal communities. There's an urgent necessity to come to grips with this. And I know the Aboriginal leadership itself feels most strongly about it. But what the answer is, it's the most significant problem, human problem, that Australia has to face. With migrant communities from overseas, I think we've had a remarkable success. But with our Indigenous population, we have not. And that is our greatest failure to this point.
As a consequence of something said a few days ago by our mutual friend, Lawitja O'Donoghue, I wonder... what your attitude to the term stolen generation is. Is it still appropriate? Is it the one we should be using?
Well, it's a term that encapsulates a whole series of events and instances. I've seen the laws, I've seen the regulations, which gave authority to the Aboriginal protectors, a nice word, to take any Aboriginal or part or mixed blood Aboriginal away from his mother or parents if the Aboriginal protector thought it a wise thing to do. And reading the literature of the pre-war era, they were concerned about breeding out the Aboriginal race. And you can't get away from that. I've read their words. I've read their actions. So when the law sanctions taking without any cause except race a young child from a mother, what word do you use for it? Do you say it's theft? Can it be theft when the law itself sanctions it? It's a brutal, intolerant, stupid law. I think the term stolen generation encapsulates what was happening through far too much of our history, and I suspect that any chance or any attempt to change it in the broad will fail.
What next for you?
I'm not sure. I'm still very much involved with CARE, but I have been trying to clear my decks to look around and see what I want to do with the rest of my life. I've stopped a number of overseas commitments, which will keep me out of long-range aircraft, and that will certainly please me. I'm still probably a bit too busy to really make that basic judgment. What am I going to do next? Because when you've got a lot of day-to-day things on your desk, it's hard to get an answer to the question, what will you do if you don't have something to do? Because I know I wouldn't sit around and do nothing. I'm trying to get into that position, because maybe I'll try and write, but I think I might prefer to write about the future than about the past.
Your old combatant, Gough Whitlam, has a committee working on his state funeral, choreographing it. It's going to be a beauty. Do you think about yours?
No, I do not. And I don't even know where I want to be buried.
Are you concerned that you're running out of time? Does this...
I'm not conscious of it. I'm well aware that if you've had 70 good years, you've had much more than you've got left. In all sorts of ways, if you're drinking a glass of wine, the amount of good wine wine you can drink for the rest of your life is finite. It's a pity, therefore, to spoil it with bad wine.
The voice of the late Malcolm Fraser speaking to Philip Adams in February 2001. And that brings us to an end of this edition of Late Night Live. Tune in next Monday evening after the 10 o'clock news here on RN.